Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Steve Jobs leaves behind a prolific legacy of innovation and many questions about his battle with a rare form of pancreatic cancer. To that end, today's program, co-produced by Susie Montgomery, is dedicated to answering some of the most common questions about pancreatic cancer and current research in Utah on treating and diagnosing the disease. The cancer can invade nearby tissues, shed cancer cells into the abdomen, and spread to distant organs. Robert Collette shares a very real story about his struggle with pancreatic cancer at the Huntsman Cancer Institute, a world-renowned center for major contributions to cancer genetics research. The $100 million building, amassed of marble and glass, sits at the base of the foothills overlooking the Salt Lake Valley. This is the place. And Collette and his wife, Shauna, are here waiting to see the doctor.
Post-op for pancreas cancer with Dr. Mulvihill. Checked me out and gave me my requirements for the next couple of months, which will be involved radiation and some chemo. Outlook looks a lot better than it did before the surgery, so we're pressing on with the treatments, see what we can do.
Pancreatic cancer is a disease where malignant cancer cells are found in the tissues of the pancreas. The pancreas is about 6 inches long and shaped like a leaf. It has two major functions in the body: to produce digestive juices and to make hormones such as insulin and glycogen that aid in digestion and metabolism regulation. In 2010, more than 43,000 Americans were diagnosed with the disease, and 36,800 died from it. The prognosis is alarming, with fewer than 5% still alive 5 years after diagnosis. Causes include age, particularly 60 years or older, smoking, diabetes, obesity, diets high in red meat and low in fruits and vegetables, as well as diets high in fructose-laden soft drinks, which have shown to be linked to the growth of pancreatic cancer cells. Also, men are 30% more likely to get pancreatic cancer, and it is hereditary.
My mother died at 59 with pancreatic cancer. I just turned 59. So when they told me what I had, it was quite a shock, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I was in the service at the time. I spent 10 years in the Navy, so I'd fly up on weekends with military, and I'd watched her go step by step to where my half-brothers watched her go day by day, so. They didn't notice the change, but it was drastic for me to see her once a month like that until she died. But back then, there was nothing they could have done for her.
There's been a lot of progress in the past decade since the death of Robert's mother. Dr. Sean Mulvihill, chairman of the Department of Surgery at the University of Utah, treats cancer patients. He is working with a team of researchers at the University of Utah Nanotechnology Institute to develop a magnetic sensor cancer screening device the size of a laptop, capable of detecting cancer in less than 10 minutes.
It's an unprecedented time right now of discovery in terms of understanding the changes in those cancer cells that offer targets for novel treatments that we didn't have before. So I think there's a lot of hope for the future that we're going to find new treatments that are more effective. It's unfortunately not as simple as we imagined back in the 1960s when this war on cancer started, that we thought there would be a cure for cancer, that there would be a defined set of abnormalities in the cancer cell that we would understand completely and we would be able to target and eradicate the cancer. But I think what we've learned now is that these tumors are all so different, and there's so many different abnormalities in the cancer cells compared to normal cells, that it's not going to be as simple as targeting one defect in the cell and eradicating it. It's going to be probably multiple directions of treatment, multiple types of drugs or agents that might address different aspects of the changes in the cancer cell.
Pancreatic cancer is the fourth most deadly cancer, and it is difficult to detect in its early stages. Only 20% of the patients who see a doctor have a localized tumor, which was the case for Robert. Dr. Mulvihill removed Robert's tumor from his pancreas last July.
Most of the patients, at least 80% of them, present at a time when the tumor has already spread to other organs. And only about 20% of patients have a tumor that's still localized to the pancreas. And that's very different than in other tumors, like in breast cancer today, over 80% of patients have small tumors confined to the breast, and only about 20% have tumors that have spread to other organs at the time they're diagnosed. So it's a completely different pattern, let's say, of discovery of the tumors.
Though Mulvihill removed the tumor early, Robert is back at the Huntsman Cancer Institute for chemotherapy and radiation treatments because they found cancer cells in a blood vessel near his pancreas.
So when were you tested for the first time?
You know, I had showing signs of like gallstones. So I went in complaining of pain in my back and like my rib cage was being ripped out. And at that time frame, it was stage one, almost to stage two, which is unheard of to show signs like that. So they found it on a CAT scan. They called me in the next day. I had another CAT scan. So that's when they identified a tumor on the top of the pancreas. So I was most fortunate that it was found when it was. Because usually when you get those kind of signs, you're too late, stage three or four, and there's nothing they can do for you, you know. At least that's the way we were led to believe.
Did you have an idea because of your mother that, or have?
I didn't have a clue. Like I said, when they told me what it was just like getting shot in the head, you know. It's just good grief. Not me, you know. Normally they only cut 6 inches, but I'm being a big fella. They about had to saw me in half. So I got a scar that's probably around 15 inches. You know, it's 31 staples holding this boy together, so.
Starting this month, Robert has 4 to 6 more months of treatments.
Hopefully by then I'll get my life back. That means I've given it a year. That's a long time to live with something like this, you know. But then again, I remember my mother. She didn't get to live with it, you know. So I'm most fortunate. Mm-hmm. Worst case scenario, what I can figure, because they can't give you odds or anything, but with treatment we're looking at getting checked down the road. Should be 4 years plus, you know. So could be a reoccurrence, might never be a reoccurrence. So see what the good Lord has in mind, go with that. I was most fortunate that the treatment they gave me worked for me. They could give it to another person and the tumor might grow. So the good Lord's looking after it. So it increased my odds. Of course, you know, you wish for the miracle cure, but I think I'm seeing enough miracles with this hospital as it is. So.
Robert agreed to participate in Dr. Mulvihill's study in hopes of contributing to a breakthrough in finding a cure for cancer.
You look on the outside and you think, well, is this a money maker, like they say? And okay, who would make money on it? You know, who would even think of something like that? So I think that eventually there'll be a breakthrough, maybe not for my kind of cancer for a while, but something's got to give, you know? Yeah, I believe in the research part of it, because if nobody's looking into it, then what's the sense of it, you know?
Dr. Mulvihill sees enormous potential with the magnetic sensor device. He says the sensor will allow his team to individualize the patient's therapy, and this is critical because each patient and each tumor is unique.
So the tumors, it turns out, to our surprise, are all quite different, and their biology is different, and that means that the things that might circulate in the bloodstream as markers for the tumor are also different.
A biomarker, or biological marker, is a traceable substance injected into the body in order to detect a change in a protein that then correlates with the progression of a disease. Mark Porter is a USAR researcher and the co-director of the Nano Institute of Utah. He has worked on the sensor for several years, and the research team was awarded a $2.3 million federal grant last November from the National Institutes of Health to use nanotechnology to detect pancreatic cancer. Their magnetic sensor uses technology similar to a music CD reader and can identify distinct magnetic fluctuations.
This is the technology that reads data off your computer hard drive. So the idea is, if you think about how fast you read information off a hard drive, how small it is, think about potentially moving that technology into the landscape for early disease detection. The number of markers we could, in theory, look for, how fast we could read the markers, and then hopefully be able to create a platform that's low cost, and down the road, these kinds of tests would be accessible to everybody.
Porter envisions a future where the sensors or scanners are inexpensive enough for use at the local pharmacy, where individuals could get tested for evidence of disease in a couple of minutes. And with automation, operating them would not take much training, so the results could be delivered quickly to the patient's physician. Michael Granger is a research scientist on the team.
It's all about magnetics. So, in a sense, I call it a black box. You push a button and you get a number out. For me, a black box is a bit of a quagmire. I like to know what's happening. I need to make sure that it's moving along correctly. But in a doctor's hands, he or she just wants to know the number and an accurate reading of the analyte of interest. And so you push a button, out comes a reading, and that, you know, I'm not sure how things would move in this era of, we're moving into the era of personalized medicine. And so I think that many things will change in our healthcare industry as with regard to the way in which data is read, data is transmitted, stored, and who has access to those data.
An antibody and nanoparticle bind to a protein, and then, reading the nanoparticle-protein combinations on a chip, the device can profile endless amounts of proteins simultaneously, a process called multiplexing. Porter explains what they expect to find are specific biomarkers or groups of biomarkers that may indicate the onset of pancreatic cancer before the patient even begins to feel any symptoms.
Conceptually, it could really look for millions. The challenge that we have in science and medicine is we don't have a good handle on what markers may be linked to certain kinds of diseases.
Mulvihill says that so far there are 6 to 8 biomarkers that have promise as markers for this cancer.
And we expect that there might be markers that today are unknown, but we might discover along the course of this work.
With continued progress in this nanotechnology research, and as more biomarkers are discovered, the possibilities are far-reaching, extending beyond disease detection to finding environmental pollutions and more. The development of the scanner is complex. The actual screening is simple. The process is taking a drop of fluid, any fluid, putting it on a chip, and reading it.
It could be whole blood, we believe. It could be serum samples. It could be urine samples, spinal fluid. It could also, of course, be tap water, groundwater, different kinds of things like this. So the technology itself, which we're pursuing for human health, it's extensible, as the folks at the National Institutes of Health would say, meaning changing the antibodies or other recognition materials we put on each of the addresses of the chip, you could begin to look for other things. So we've done work, for example, in terms of looking at surrogates that would be related to biowarfare agents for Homeland Security. We can do E. coli, begin to think about doing those kinds of things. So we can look for, you know, it could potentially be applicable in a food safety and security type of format. Lots of different things.
After a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer, the 5-year survival rate is about 5%. And this is the lowest survival rate of any cancer. This magnetic sensor technology is crucial, though it is still uncertain if and when it will become available. It might be several years or decades down the road. Still, there's an optimism among the researchers that this magnetic sensor will become the device that can detect pancreatic cancer and ultimately other cancers early enough to save lives.
Back at the Huntsman Cancer Institute with pancreatic cancer patient Robert Collette and his wife, Shauna.
Well, you know, just the word cancer is a scary word. I mean, you know, because I lost both my parents with different kinds. It's just a scary word, so.
How much have you had to change your lifestyle since you were diagnosed in July?
Well, I was an avid smoker. I loved to smoke. I mean, I did. I loved cigarettes. I didn't care how much they cost. You know, I liked the taste and everything. But other than that, that's about the biggest lifestyle change.
That must have been hard.
You know what? I picked a date and I just quit cold turkey. And I haven't had any regrets and it hasn't bothered me. Now, I've never heard of smoking causing cancer other than lung cancer. But it goes right straight to the pancreas. I took a chance. So 3 ways to Sunday, I was out. I should have known right off the bat that it was going to snag me in that arena, you know.
Did your mother smoke?
Oh, yeah. She smoked the Pall Mall Reds, no filters. No. She loved to smoke.
I used to smoke, too. I quit like 5 years ago, though. I don't think I enjoyed it as much as I did. Gosh.
It's hard to explain to somebody because you reach a threshold that you get tired. And when you reach it, it's too late. It knocks you in the dirt for 2 days. You know, and that happened to me twice when I was on chemo before. But the main thing is just go steady and don't overdo it, you know. And scary thought, having to go through it again because, geez, by the time you reach that threshold, it's too late, you know. And boy, it just knocks you down.
Is it a death sentence or, you know? But each time we come, like today, we got good news. Like, he's got his timeline set up, I think. He said to the doctor, Mobihill, well, I got 6 years. He said, well, I wouldn't say that. He probably, who knows, you know?
You feel like sometimes you're on the USS Never Dock. You're on the ship that's crossing the river, you know? Got 2 coins to pay your way. But then again, you talk to somebody else and they say, oh, no, you're in good shape compared to this and that, you know. You're coming along pretty good. So, you know, it depends where your attitude's at, where your head is at. And if you've got a good head or attitude about it, it helps quite a bit in the healing process and everything else.
Special thanks to Robert Collette for generously sharing his story. Sherry Quinn for Access Utah.
This is Contemporary Western Women. I'm Elaine Thatcher. Amy Velasquez is a middle school teacher in Evanston, Wyoming. Her family was one of the first Hispanic families in Evanston, coming there in the 1950s. It is important to her to preserve and share her Mexican heritage, so she created a Cinco de Mayo celebration for the school, which grew to be a town celebration.
Well, each year it kind of started off as just a class. I teach Spanish, so my students were doing a festival at the school, and it just kind of got really big. And so I proposed it to the city, and they thought it was a great idea, and they gave us some seed money to get started, and we organized. My dancers perform. I teach a group of 8th grade Hispanic dance students, and they learn 10 dances from Mexico and 1 dance from Spain, and they perform at the elementary schools on the Friday before the festival to get all the children excited to go to the fiesta. And then on Saturday, the kids are in charge of basically putting the whole festival together. My committee, I have a committee of 12 adults that we are in charge of, you know, getting all the entertainment and the advertisement and the money. And the students physically put it together. They set up all the booths, they organize the chairs, they blow up the balloons, they make the decorations, everything. They clean it up. So yeah, it's a good opportunity for them to get to be a part of their community as well. and have a more first-hand experience with the Hispanic culture. My Cinco de Mayo committee puts together a tortilla making booth, so you can come and make a tortilla for free all day long. We do paper flower making, flores de papel, we do ojos de Dios. Well, in my class, we do all of the cultural projects. We make papel picado, you know, for Dia de los Muertos. Mm-hmm. We set up an ofrenda, an offering mm-hmm. in my classroom for Dia de los Muertos, and all the children bring in a picture or something of a family member who's passed away, and we all just kind of remember them for the week. And it's very moving for them. I'm surprised at how deep it goes for those kids.
Are these all things you learned as a kid mm-hmm. in your family?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. And I just love the culture. It's my culture, so I love to share it with the students. My mom came to Evanston as a child, not speaking English, even though she was born in Colorado. But she spoke only Spanish in the home, so she learned to speak English in Evanston. I do it, I think, to keep the memory of my grandparents, because they were such an important part of my life that I want to share that with my own children and like my other children at school.
Contemporary Western Women is a project of Utah State University's Center for Women and Gender and Utah Public Radio. We focus on women in the Rocky Mountain region and their stories of strength, hope, and humor in all aspects of life. If you have a story to share or know someone who does, please visit the Contemporary Western Women link at upr.org or call 1-800-826-1495. I'm Elaine Thatcher.
Did you know that graduates of Instructional Technology and Learning Sciences can land high-paying jobs in several different sectors, including K-12 and higher education, corporate America, government, and government subcontractors?
Did You Know That is made possible by the USU Emma Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services. More at cehs.usu.edu.
Support for Science Questions comes from USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn.
And I'm Susie Montgomery. Science Questions travel to the largest international gem fair in the world in Tucson, Arizona, where 50,000 like-minded fossil, gem, and meteorite enthusiasts, the true rockers, attend an annual show that is reminiscent of the Silk Road. Trade routes extending for miles and miles across Tucson and into Phoenix, serving as a path for cultural, commercial, and scientific exchange between collectors, academics, rock hounds, dealers, and museum curators.
Yeah, we come from Congo. It's the big show in the world. Mohamed Tahiri from Morocco. This is trilobites, and this, we found them in the middle of stone.
It's a nice aquamarine piece. We would call it ocean blue. Like when you go to the beach and you are looking at deep ocean, this is the color you will see.
Hi, my name is Milan. I came from Czech Republic, and we have some moldavites over there. This stone came somewhere from our republic, and it belongs to the group of tektite. And the special of that stone is that the green color. Only one of those have green color.
Die Anmeldeinformation. Das ist so ein gelber Umschlag.
Мы едем на месторождение, собираем эти образцы, камни. Что-то собираем сами, что-то там покупаем.
Jeff Notkin, co-host of the popular series called Meteorite Men on the Science Channel, is a gem show enthusiast.
It's the biggest event of its type in the world by far. Typically, there are about 600,000 buyers, 4,500 vendors, and this quirky, fabulous Wild West city, which I love and which has adopted me, becomes the heart and the nerve center of the whole natural history collecting world for 2 weeks.
The whole city turns into a nomadic camp. Thousands of merchant tents erected everywhere, city blocks of RVs creating small neighborhoods, all cradled in the Sonoran cactus-filled desert. And people from across the globe are here.
I wait the whole year for this. I don't care about my birthday or Christmas or New Year's. This is my favorite time of the year.
That was Gerardo Leyva from Z's Minerals Company based in Tucson.
Who do you want to hang out with? Czechs, Russians, Mexicans, Europe, South Americans, who do you want to hang out with? And you can pick your nationality and you can go to parties and music. And the whole year goes around and then I can be talking to you and then the next year I still have the same conversation, like time didn't pass. And you create such a great friendships and you have friends all over the world after this. If the more languages you spoke, the better you would be. Mm-hmm. I wish I spoke all the languages so I could talk to everybody.
These international vendors take over hundreds of hotel rooms, each with their own style and cultural flair. Some rooms were draped in exotic velvets and linens. Others featured glass cases of impressive dinosaur remains. And others, spinning showcases of rare and expensive gems and extraterrestrial meteorite rocks. Stefan Detman's room was like walking into a fancy high-end art gallery, intimate and dimly lit, with ambiotic techno music playing in the background. The red walls were hung with perfectly complete fossils, mounted with an artist's hand. The room was high class.
We are working in a company in Germany which is selling minerals and fossils. We changed into a gallery for large fossil murals or wall decorations, wall coverings, or large objects of crystal or petrified wood. So we changed into interior, and this is pretty new. This is even for Germany unique, and we are out of concurrence at all. This is maybe very interesting to hear. We're here with collectibles, and now we changed into decorative art. Art in case of, we are saying that fossils are also something like an oil painting. Mm-hmm. So there's a scientific background. We have just academic degrees in our company, so this is very high level own preparation, but we have also a heart for art. And this is what we are trying to sell or trying to show, just to meet people somewhere in the stomach.
Stefan was a tall German man with a solid frame. Long, gray blonde hair neatly pulled back into a ponytail. He was wearing a black suit coat with a black t-shirt that said,
You get what you deserve.
He shows us the skull of a young, primitive whale known as the Basilosaurus that lived 40 million years ago in the Eocene time period, when the first modern mammals emerged. The Basilosaurus is recorded as the largest animal of its time, around 60 feet long with a very elongated snout, almost eel-like. These seldom-found ancient whale fossils have surfaced in Egypt and Pakistan, as well as closer to home. In fact, the Basilosaurus is the state fossil of Alabama and Mississippi. This one piece was priced at $88,000.
There's just 10 skulls of Basilosaurus in the world, and this is freshly prepared. So this is a museum piece too, as every single piece we have. This is more than 75% original material or bone material on the skull. So this is from the Eocene. This is an ichthyosaur. This is from the Lias Epsilon. This is a Jurassic suborder. And this piece is exceptional because of its, or due to its skin preservation. So you see the fins, and this is more than rare. This is a museum piece, of course. Totally articulated, and there's no restorations, and this is very, very special to have.
Where is it from?
This is from Germany, this is from South Germany, the Holzmaden area. Holzmaden is a famous area with quarries. It's situated in the Swabian Alp. This is a national park, but there exist quarries, and we have large layers with amazing fossils like crinoids, ichthyosaurs, different bony fishes. So this is a place to be.
It was obviously one of the places to be. Though, of course, there were many others, Alaska being one. On our way to a local bar to attend an annual meteorite awards party, we bumped into Kirvin, who happened to be from Alaska, and he was cradling a cardboard box.
What is this that you're holding in a basket like a baby?
Well, it's an ammonite. This ammonite is a cephalopod. It's a relative of a, well, like an octopus or a squid or a chambered nautilus.
How did you find it and why did you find it?
Well, I found it just hiking around in the mountains in Alaska. I spend some of the summer just looking for fossils, things like this.
Why did you bring it here? What's the point?
Because it's something different, and I'm showing it to some of the people here because there's some experts here from around the world that know these things real well, and I wanted to show it to them because it's, you know, because it's unique.
Have they seen it yet?
Yeah, they've seen it, and they got all excited about it, and they're interested in studying it. It's just unusual.
How long have you been searching for these kinds of nautilus creatures?
I guess I've been looking for them for about probably 15 years.
Ammonites are an extinct group of mollusks that include more common species such as octopus, squid, snails, and bivalves like mussels and clams.
I guess the closest thing alive today would be the chambered nautilus. And the chambered nautilus is, coil, like it gets larger, kind of like almost like a snail, but different. Whereas these were kind of like, almost shaped like a trombone, kind of like a giant paperclip maybe. We don't really know why they were that shape, because it's kind of odd. Doesn't make too much sense, because if they were trying to swim quickly, that wouldn't really help them. The way this one is unusual, the ending of it, which doesn't make sense. We haven't seen ones like this before, so it's kind of makes us curious as to why it looks the way it does.
So how much is this worth?
Oh, I don't know.
Would you sell it?
No. No, I collect these because I really like them, but something like this, if I left it outside, nobody would steal it because it's not... wouldn't be worth carrying off, but it's unique, and to scientists it's kind of important because it's something different and something worth studying.
Ammonites were diverse and abundant at the fair. They range from the size of a thumbnail to the size of a semi-truck tire. They look like a modern snail's shell and are prized not only for their striking beauty, but also because they serve as a reference point for dating Earth's sediments, aiding in the exploration of petroleum and other economic products, and also in reconstructing the history of the Earth. We caught Neil L. Larson, vice president of the Black Hills Institute of Geological Research, a company located in Hill City, South Dakota, on Super Bowl Sunday in a crowded hotel ballroom on the Paleo Patio, right in front of a fossilized Triceratops skull marked at $250,000 and sold to a group from Japan.
And I'm a geologist and a paleontologist. I'm impassioned with fossils. I'm impassioned with specifically ammonites, invertebrates, fossil squid, fossil octopus. I write on them extensively. I do research. I give talks worldwide. This is my company's 37th year at Tucson. And what keeps us coming back is that there's no other place in the world where you can come and you can see paleontology, geology, and mineralogy from all over the world exhibited in one place, where you have people who are out in the field and actively collecting it, and they're not only looking just to find specimens for ore, not just looking for industry, but they're looking for the perfect specimens where you can go and you can display these things. The world's finest museums come to Tucson every year to shop. They come to look for the best specimens in the world because they know that they do not have the money to go out and search for them in the field and be assured that they can find them. They also know that the best preparators in the world for fossil specimens and for mineral specimens and for rock specimens are the hobbyists, the amateurs, and the professional collectors that are out there.
Ammonites are geometrically symmetrical and are a fascinating naturally occurring example of the mathematical Fibonacci sequence. They have sutures dividing the spiral into sections that are reminiscent of a fractal, where any section of the spiral of the ammonite, split no matter how many times, remains a reduced-size copy of the whole. They are most often displayed embedded into rough rock, and their multicolored translucence is appealing.
They are remarkable animals. They tell us much about the history of our Earth, part of our history that is lost. They're relatives of the squid and the octopus and the modern-day nautilus, but they went extinct at the same time as the dinosaurs. They came along long before the dinosaurs, back in the Paleozoic, in the earliest Devonian, latest Silurian period, lived in the Earth for 340 million years, and then all of a sudden one day they went extinct. We don't know why. They're one of the most common fossils that we find in the Earth's crust in Mesozoic rocks. Yet we don't know what they looked like. We've never yet found the soft body tissue, or have not yet recognized the soft body tissue, of what their arms were like, what their eyes were like. We are finding traces and elements and parts of their soft body tissue in the inside. So we're getting to look at intestines and stomach and other things. So we're learning more about them there. But it's been my goal since 1990 to discover the soft body tissue. So I'm starting to look in lots of different ways, through UV, through X-rays, through the synchrotron at Stanford, and other methods. I want to be the first to find what they actually look like.
He is not the only one who tries to be first on the scene. Meteorite hunter Jeff Notkin of Tucson, Arizona, a celebrity at the Gem Fest due to his popular series Meteorite Men on the Science Channel, describes the hunting strategies when chasing fireballs.
There are three basic hunting strategies that we use for meteorites, and the most colorful is called fireball chasing. So a fireball is a very large meteor, an incoming piece of cosmic debris that's burning in the atmosphere. And fireballs of sufficient size may fragment into pieces and scatter meteorites on the ground. So when a fireball is seen by credible observers, and especially if it's caught on video camera, then we're very interested. And by examining video footage, interviewing eyewitnesses, we can begin to calculate where pieces might have fallen. So Steve, my co-host on the Meteorite Men television series, and I typically take off one, two, or three times per year on a harebrained fireball chase. And meteorites seem to land in the most inconvenient places most of the time. It couldn't be nearby or somewhere where it's just nice and clean and open. They may land in woodland or rocky mountains or on restricted land. And this happened to us late in 2009. And there was an episode of our television series about it. There was a gigantic fireball over Utah, and it was seen by many eyewitnesses in Salt Lake City.
Using Doppler radar and eyewitness testimony, the Meteorite Men track a meteorite down to the Dugway military base. Military officials grant Jeff Notkin and his co-host, Steve Arnold, exclusive access to the dangerous ammunition testing grounds to search for pieces of the fall.
And so Steve jumped in his car and I jumped on a plane and we rocketed up there and we searched all around. It was actually for once an ideal hunting surface because of the white salt flats. There are very few rocks. It's really open. We're looking for dark colored rocks that are out of place. And we go, oh great, finally at last. A meteorite's landed in a place where we can really get to it and probably see something from far away. And then after we'd done all our calculations and had been assisted by our colleague Rob Mattson, who's a scientist and a specialist in plotting where meteorites might have landed, we eventually concluded it landed right in the middle of the Dugway Military Proving Ground, which is not just any old army base. The Dugway is about the size of the state of Delaware. It's a gigantic area west of Salt Lake City, and it's nicknamed Area 52. It's a top secret testing installation where the U.S. Army, Marines, Navy, Air Force test all kinds of new and amazing and probably hugely devastating weapons. So, A, they don't want some rockheads like us wandering around watching them do secret testing. And B, there's unexploded stuff lying everywhere. Going back to the World War II era, and the Dugway was, the project was started by General Eisenhower in the 40s, and initially, it was used for many different testing functions, but notably gunnery practice for heavy bombers, for B-17s and B-29s. So there are thousands of 50 caliber machine gun cartridges lying all over the salt flats out there. Missiles, bombs, rocket parts, the countermeasures that they fire out of the back of a jet to confuse heat-seeking missiles. I mean, you can't walk for 5 minutes out there without seeing something that looks really dangerous. So we thought, well, this is all over. We went all the way around north, south, east, west, all four areas, all four compass points of the Dugway, and hunted thoroughly and found nothing except unexploded warheads and shell cases and all kinds of interesting things. And then eventually, after several months of effort and amazing cooperation from the armed forces, who were not only incredibly helpful but really interested in what we were doing, we got clearance from the Pentagon to go onto the base. And we had to go out with two unexploded ordnance specialists, and their job is to go out and blow up dangerous stuff on the testing range. So we're out there hiking across the salt flats with these two guys and an armed Marine escort. So there was the classic example of a meteorite landing in a place that was an absolutely ideal hunting location, and we couldn't get to it. We did go quite far out onto the Dugway, and it was very frustrating because we felt that we were just getting to the zone where we would expect to find pieces. And the officers go, well, that's it. That's as far as we go. And the area we were heading to had been used for testing, we were told, nerve gas agents, I suppose. Again, probably back in the Vietnam era. And they didn't want to have anything to do with it.
We are not showing to anyone.
Ancient treasure.
A lot of meteorites are worth more than gold.
Ooh, and a journey that's out of this world.
What could be more mysterious and exciting than looking for lost bits of the universe that have landed on Earth?
Two men.
Look at that!
One obsession.
These meteorites are packed with gemstones from outer space.
Meteorite Man. The hunt begins Wednesday, January 20th.
There is an interesting statistic that 8 to 10 meteorites are thought to fall on each square mile of the surface of our planet every year. But they're tiny. Meteorites do fall all the time, but most of them are very, very small. Smaller than a pea, probably smaller than a pinhead, dust-sized particles. And so there's an interesting phenomenon in play here, which is the mass of our planet is actually growing as cosmic material lands. But new recoverable meteorites, in other words, a piece that's large enough to see and find, are very rare. There might be 3, 4, or 5 meteorite-producing events each year worldwide that are witnessed.
In fact, there was a witnessed fall of a meteorite in Nigeria back in 1962, and this was no ordinary rock. It is the most expensive piece in Eric Olson's collection.
That would be this slice of Mars here. It's $45,000.
Interesting. It's the most plain looking.
It is very plain looking, yes.
But it's Mars.
And probably the second most is the lunar slice down here. That's $30,000. This little iron slice is down here. That's a brand new iron that came. And the pattern on it looks like little crosses. And so that's something new. It's a little bit different than anything everybody's seen before.
Now retired from a long career in the military, Olson now buys, sells, and trades meteorites in Tucson, Arizona.
They come from space. They make out of this world Christmas gifts.
There is an especially sought-after group of meteorites called palisites that make up a small percentage, an estimated 3.5%, of all meteorites recovered on Earth. Jeff Notkin explains.
You've got the rarity of palisites. Of the thousands and thousands of different meteorites that have been found worldwide, there are only about 35 palisites known, so they're extremely rare. They're extremely beautiful. They have this amazing color and translucency that's unlike any terrestrial rock. And they contain gemstones. So then you have a crossover with the gem people becoming interested. And I think gem people are typically very sophisticated people. The study of gems is quite a complex discipline, and I think a lot of gem collectors and mineral collectors sort of look at meteorites and go, oh, they're so ugly, it's just kind of an old rusty bit of iron. But when they see palisades, it's a whole different story. Now we have an extraterrestrial rock that's got gemstones in it. All of a sudden, everybody's interested in that.
These are cool, huh?
I think I want to get a couple really quick, though.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's pretty. I think I like that one.
Well, when the light hits it, it's good.
Be up against the yellow wall.
Two brothers were running the Pakistani gem display. One a chemical engineer, and the other brother oversaw the mine. Their hotel room was simply decorated, but hosted some spectacular foot-long towers of emeralds, the color of cool mint. They had some of the most vibrant colored gems in the show. An unforgettable red ruby glistened in the case.
Aquamarine we have from Pakistan, then a few emeralds and then rubies also. So these are the special stones from Pakistan.
They explained that their father had started the mining business, which they've now inherited. Mohammed Delasoun talks about the most important and rare emerald cluster.
They don't come in cluster like this very often, but sometimes. That's why when we saw them in the cluster, I mean, the combination is very rare also. So that's why we got them.
The objects at the Tucson Gem Fair inspire a sense of wonder about the Earth and evolution. We were awed by dresser drawer-sized boxes full of hundreds of ancient shark's teeth, trilobites, complete fossilized tortoises, and a still-yet unidentified arm-length skeleton of a prehistoric sea creature, going for a starting price of $30,000.
Despite getting swept up in the science and intrigue of the fair, there was something unsettling about selling these unearthed and rare pieces of natural history to the highest bidder. When you dig something up, you take it out of its original context or frame forever and potentially thwart scientific discovery. We consulted the state archaeologist Dr. Kevin Jones on this issue. He emailed us his perspective. I consider private ownership of rare historic or scientific treasures to be undesirable. They should be available for broad enjoyment and study. However, things found on private property belong to the landowner, and they have every right to own and sell them. I do think the most unfortunate aspect of the private excavation of such things often results in destruction of the context in pursuit of the artifact or fossil. Thus, most of the valuable information associated with the object is destroyed. Generally in the American West, since most land is public, a substantial amount of the fossils and artifacts people sell at gem and artifact shows were illegally obtained, despite their alleged certificates of provenance.
Our journey to the Tucson Gem Fair was originally spurred by the efforts of Duke Johnson, education manager of the Clark Planetarium in Salt Lake City. He attended the fair to buy meteorites for Utah schools to use in their classrooms. He says the space rocks inspire young people and get them interested in science.
Well, they're over 4.5 billion years old. So that's just pretty neat because most of the rocks that we can get our hands on anywhere around Utah or beyond, you know, you're lucky if you're touching rocks that are over 1 billion years old. Our big focus is the sixth grade. And those students have about 2/3 of their curriculum that involves space. Even for those, though, that aren't studying that particularly, it really helps to get us remembering what our place is and how special Earth is. And, you know, it makes the connections for the kids as to how cool space is and how cool science is. And it just is something that sticks with them a lot more than a lot of other things do.
Meteorite science teaches us about the rest of the universe. We can't get to the asteroid belt yet as people, hopefully one day. But until then, studying bits of the asteroid belt that have come to us is the next best thing.
And that's our show for this week. Thank you for listening. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. For more information, visit sqradio.com. www.lunarslice.org.
I'm Chris Bray with the Utah Nonprofits Association. The life-changing work of Utah's nonprofits is made possible by your heartfelt support. Please make this month meaningful with a tax-deductible Valentine to the local charity of your choice.
Established in 1999, the English Language Center of Cache Valley has become a model for ESL programming throughout northern Utah, serving over 1,000 students annually from 94 countries around the world. Rhonda Kingsford is the center's co-director.
I have seen adults that have lived here in Cache Valley for 20-some-odd years that are just barely getting enough courage to come into the center. Or we have just newly arriving people that have been in Cache Valley maybe a week or a month that come. So we have a variety of people, but the main thing is they are scared to death when they come in, and a lot of them, their hands are shaking, they're just so nervous. And we try very, very hard to make them feel comfortable. We try to downplay the stress that they feel. Because of the language barrier, people that come here to our community from different countries, they're not able to get the jobs they need or help their children in school. It's so critical that they learn our language, and it's so rewarding to see them have that courage to walk in the door, to start learning the language and become part of our community, because English is the key.
Utah Cares is a partnership between the Utah Nonprofits Association, Utah Public Radio, and KCPW. For more information, visit upr.org and follow the Utah Cares link.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from Messina Wildlife Management, manufacturer of organic animal repellents under the Animal Stopper name. Retailer location and other information is at stopanimaldamage.com.